Okay, so let's go back to the text. If you recall, when last we left David, he had run away to the Philistines because Saul was pursuing him all over Israel, and well, all over the territory of Israel that Israel still had sovereignty over, and he was caught in a sort of double bind that he miraculously escaped. That is, Achish, who was the king, wanted him to go to war against Israel with the Philistines. David seemed prepared to do that, or at least didn't say that he wasn't, until Achish's generals said, "No, we don't trust him, and we don't want him to go to war with us," by which he got out of the necessity of going to war, and yet was not killed by Achish for betrayal. So he goes off to his little preserve with his marauding band of people. And I was reading some, I meant to mention this last time, something interesting, which is a byway that is worth mentioning. And that is in chapter 29, verse 3. It says, "Vayomru Sarei Plishtim." The head of the Philistine officer said, "Ma ha'ivrim ha'ele?" Who are these Ivrim? Now, Ivrim is Hebrew, as you know, and he doesn't refer to them as Israelites. Already in scholarship a long time ago, there was a possible identification with what are called the Hapiru, which are cognates of Ivrim and the Israelites. And what happened in very broad strokes is, early on, there are Egyptian documents that refer to the Hapiru. So people thought maybe the Israelites, because Hebrew, Hapiru, even in English you can hear some affinity, maybe the Israelites were in fact the Hapiru, and we have found them now in ancient Israelite documents. And people got very excited about this for obvious reasons. Until what happened was they then found the same name, Hapiru, in other surrounding civilizations to refer basically to marauding bands of bandits. And they realized that it was a generic name, it wasn't a specific tribal name. But that being the case, it's not impossible that referring to David this way says something about who David is and how he's perceived. That is, he's not an Israelite king, he's a marauder and a bandit. And the reason that Achish trusted him is because he assumed he has no morals, so seriously. So, I mean, you can trust somebody who has no morals if, in fact, you're the powerful one. Then you can command their trust. Right? Somebody who has principles can always, can always betray you because you violate them, but if they have no principles, then it's self-interest that governs them, and as long as you can rule their self-interest, it's like a mafia mob. So if David, in fact, only has self-interest, and that's the way Achish thinks about him, then we understand why Achish trusts him, because he assumes, yeah, he kills Israelites, that's what he would do, and he can go to war with us because we're going to win. My guess is that his generals don't feel that way, or at least they don't trust him. But, and we're not sure that the reference to David here as Ephraim means Hapiru, but it is at least possible. And so the way that David is seen by the Philistines might not be that different from the way that he's seen by the Israelites at the moment, which is that he is, we only have it on sort of backstory that David's anointed. All the Israelites know about him is that he's a successful war hero. Okay, but he goes back to his area, which is in Ziklag, which is a city, a Philistine city. And we come to chapter 30. By the time David and his men arrived in Ziklag, and by the way, sorry, I'm interrupting myself again. But the One thing that we might do once we finish the first book of Samuel to bridge the time so that when we resume in May, we start the second book, is to look at some of the Psalms. Because remember that the Psalms are also attributed to David. And if we want to understand his character, it might be worth looking at a couple of the Psalms as well to try to figure out what they say about David. Okay. By the time David and his men arrived in Ziklag, on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid into the Negev and against Ziklag. This reminds us of two things. First of all, it reminds us that the Philistines and the Israelites are not the only inhabitants of this territory, and the Amalekites, again, are a raiding band. And second, the Amalekites are, in the Torah, the arch enemy of Israel. Right? They are the, remember that we're told to forget the Amalekites, that Haman is an Amalekite, that Saul lost his kingship because he doesn't kill Agag, who is the king of the Amalekites when he's supposed to kill him. And then according to the rabbis, the way that Haman ends up being an Amalekite is because Agag copulates with someone while, you know, when he should have been killed. And that was Saul's problem, which argues for a very loose captivity in ancient Israel. But that's a separate issue. And the Amalekites are, and in fact, we're told that we're supposed to wipe out the memory of the Amalekites, which is kind of a paradoxical injunction. Remember to forget the Amalekites. Tolstoy, when he was a kid, had a club in which you had to, in order to be a part of the club, you had to go into a corner and not think of a pink elephant. Okay? Seriously, I don't know that I could ever be part of that club, and I guess you had to take people's words for it. But also, I remember I read years ago that Kant had this assistant named Lampe, L-A-M-P-E, who was his assistant for years and years, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, was his assistant for years and years, and he really relied on him. And then Lampe went and got married, and so Kant affixed what was, I guess, the 18th century equivalent of a post-it note to his desk saying, "Remember to forget Lampe." So the same thing here, which is we're supposed to wipe out the Amalekites, but of course they didn't, and we haven't. And in fact, that's part of the paradox of Purim, is that the one name that everyone listens for is the one we're supposed to be wiping out. Right? Everybody listens for Haman so that we can't hear it. So if you want somebody to do terrible things, the Amalekites are handy. And the reason, by the way, they became the archenemy of Israel is because they attacked them in the wilderness. Right? This helpless people just escaped slavery, and the Amalekites raided them. So by the time the Amalekites had made a raid into the Negev and against Ziklag, and remember that Ziklag is where everyone's family is. That is, that's where the Israelites, David and the Israelites were staying. They went to Achish to go to war, but their wives and children are still back in Ziklag. They had stormed Ziklag and burned it down. This is ancient warfare, right? You don't just take a city, you burn it to the ground. They had taken the women in it captive, low-born and high-born alike. They didn't kill any, but carried them off and went their way. So again, you know, from reading between the lines, you get a sense of what ancient warfare was like. You go into a city, you burn it down, you either take the women captive or you kill them. Which fate is worse, hard to know, but both pretty awful. And you've got to figure, for every little raid like this that we know about, because it happens to be mentioned in the Bible, there were countless examples in human history, not only in Israelite history, but in human history, of such devastation of people's lives. Which again reminds you that it really is astonishing in the course of human history to be as fortunate as we are. That's just not the way most people lived for most of life on earth. When David and his men came to the town and found it burned down, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive, David and the troops with him broke into tears until they had no strength left for weeping. Not the reaction I think that you would have anticipated if you didn't know. But you should know that in the Bible in general, men crying is not an unusual thing or or any indication of weakness. Remember that Jacob cries, that Esau cries, that Joseph cries. Right, exactly. So it's not an unusual thing. And also, presumably, if they've burned the city to the ground and they've gone away, the chances that they're going to find them are not so great. So they feel like they've lost everything. These are wives, children, and possessions, although they're less important. David's two wives have been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, wife of Nabal from Carmel. David was in great danger, for the troops threatened to stone him. We'll come back to that in a second. For all the troops were embittered on accounts of their sons and daughters. I guess they were a little embittered on account of their wives, too, although I must say that is a pretty startling omission there. And I don't know exactly what to make of it. I really don't. I can give you at least one very awful possibility, which is not, unfortunately, historically not implausible, and that is that once your wife has been violated by another man, you won't take her back. So that could be also part of what's going on here when they say they were embittered because of their sons and daughters, because they'd already written their wives off. I don't know whether that's true or not. So for example, by the way, this is in some ways, in a much more delicate way, enshrined in Jewish law. If you divorce someone, you can remarry them, but only if you haven't married someone else in the meantime. That is, you can't marry someone, divorce them, marry someone else, divorce them, and then go back to your first wife. You can only go back to your first wife if you have not married someone else in the meantime. You can marry someone, divorce them, and remarry them, but if you've married someone else, according to Jewish law, you can't.
Or even if you had a relationship with someone else.
Well, but that's marriage. In classical Jewish law, once you have a relationship, you're engaged. So I honestly don't know the answer to that. I'm assuming that it has some of this same sentiment in its deep structure. That is, that you are in some sense spoiled for her, although this is the man, not the woman, by having relations with someone else. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. God bless her. All I can tell you is, you know, the Talmud says when two people who are divorced get into bed, there are four people in the bed. Because the shadow of the person that you're divorced from. So in the case that you're talking about, it sounds to me like that bed's very crowded. I don't know. I can't tell you. I don't know how many people are in that bed, but there's a lot of them. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Well, in our law, although what it was at this time is different. Yeah. I think that at that time, when we retroject Jewish law to that time, but I mean it was much less regulated than now. My guess is that as a rule, not, but it probably depended on who the male was, what he wanted to do, but my guess is that the normal standard was not. Look, you still see this today, all the time in less developed countries of the world, that a woman is raped and her husband won't take her back. I mean, so, and rather than see this solely as a cultural difference, it's also a developmental difference. It's like ancient cultures as opposed to modern cultures. So my guess is that some of that at least endured in the Bible, although who knows? Who knows? So I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. How is it now if a married woman is being raped by someone, can she go back to her husband?
Oh, sure. In Jewish law? Absolutely. Yeah. Of course. Absolutely. All right. But the other part of this is that you notice that David's troops have now turned on him, which lets you know again, they're about to stone him, which lets you know again the extent to which his authority, or any king's authority, depends on military victory. Because the reason that people are turning to him instead of Saul is because he kills more people. But Saul still has loyalty among especially the tribe of Benjamin, but not only the tribe of Benjamin. Now David has failed militarily. He took them away from the city that was burned down, and so they're about to stone him. But David sought strength in the Lord his God. So David's ability to portray himself as a religious figure is a large part of his appeal still today, and also then, obviously. The troops must believe that he has some kind of special relationship to God because he turns to God and they listen to his listening to God. David is a charismatic figure as well as a leader. David said to the priest Abiathar, son of Ahimelech. Anybody remember who that is? If so, you're really, really good, and you've paid extraordinary attention over the course of this. Do you remember when Saul killed all these priests? One priest escapes, and David says, I will protect you forever. Now, again, so he turns to this priest. There are several ways of reading this. One way of reading it is that David is smart enough to know that every good king needs a good priest, which is true. I mean, even in our own day, if you remember when the Lewinsky scandal broke, what did Clinton do? He called all these clergy to the Oval Office and prayed with them and counseled with them, providing, I don't know the degree of genuineness then or now, I have no idea, and no one can know, but the point is that when political power fails in some way, religious covering can be redemptive. And so David, who's about to get killed by his troops, says, wait, let's talk to God, and it's always helpful to have a priest nearby. So, and which, by the way, does not mean for a second, and I don't mean to imply that David didn't believe that the priest talked to God or that he talked to God. Although it's true, interestingly, that David and God never have a direct conversation in the book of Samuel, but that's part of a pattern that you see in the Torah in general, which is that God becomes less and less and less communicative as the Torah goes on, as the Tanakh goes on. So it's not surprising that David doesn't, but he needs a priest because his people are about to stone him, and the only authority beyond himself is God. He says, bring the ephod to me. The ephod, again, is this mysterious thing that can sometimes predict the future and is sometimes used for the garments of priests, but here it's being used like the Urim and Tumim. That is, and you have to ask the ephod yes or no questions, right? You can't ask it, it doesn't speak. It's not like an oracle. It's not like the Oracle of Delphi, where you can ask it a question where it can give you actually an answer. When Abiathar brought up the ephod to David, David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue those raiders? Will I overtake them? He answered him, pursue, for you shall overtake and you shall rescue. Now, not surprising that it says yes to these things, because that's what's going to, yes. What? You look puzzled. It's probably yes in both. I mean, it quotes it that way, but the ephod doesn't really speak. When it says God answers him, it's through the ephod. It's indirect, but you can imagine David reporting, good news, guys. You don't have to stone me, because we're going to get everything back. So David and the 600 men with him set out, and they came to Vadi Besor, where a halt was made by those who were to be left behind. And if you remember, there were a certain number of people that he had left behind to guard the goods, right, who obviously were not successful in guarding the goods. And 200 men had halted, too faint to cross the Vadi Besor. So David continued the pursuit with 400 men. 200 men couldn't. Now, why were they? I mean, maybe they just didn't have the stamina, or maybe they were scared, but nonetheless, David leaves them behind. They come upon an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. Now, part of this is it's got to be very hard to track people who left 3 days ago. On the other hand, they did take a big contingent with them, and that presumably makes some kinds of tracks because they took sons and daughters and wives. They couldn't move too fast, but it's always helpful when you get somebody who's a spy who can tell you where people went. And remember that in the ancient world, that's not that uncommon. People traveled a lot, and they always traveled on foot, and they saw other bands of people. We've come across this before. So what do? They came across an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. They gave him food to eat and water to drink. He was also given a piece of pressed fig cake and 2 cakes of raisins. So you also know what they ate. And obviously they give him all this stuff because they want him to give them information, so you have to treat him well. He ate and regained his strength, for he'd eaten no food and drunk no water for 3 days and three nights. Again, probably not that uncommon in the ancient world. You know, if for whatever reason you're traveling from place A to place B, unless you're lucky, you're not going to find that much food. David asked him, "To whom do you belong and where are you from?" "I'm an Egyptian boy," he answered, "the slave of an Amalekite. My master abandoned me when I fell ill 3 days ago. We had raided the Negev of the Cherethites and the Negev of Judah and the Negev of Kalev. We also burned down Ziklag." So he was a part of the party that did this. And also you get, again, a sense of when he says, "I'm an Egyptian who was a slave," we don't usually think of Egyptians as slaves. We think of them as those who enslave. But in the ancient world, you know, you have, usually when you win a war, it's not against a country, it's against a group. So if you win a war against some Egyptian troop or group, or you raid a town in Egypt, it's so different from now. Egypt is this vast country. There are a lot of little towns. They probably have few or no troops. They have the men of that town. So if you go in and you raid and you kill the men of that town, you take the sons and the daughters captive and the women captive, and then you have slaves. And that's how the world worked. So this one slave, he didn't escape. He was abandoned because he was sick, and who needs a sick slave? But he survived long enough to be able to help David. And this also lets you know, by the way, we get indignant over the injustice of the fact that the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt, but not to say that this was a good thing, but it was ubiquitous. It was all over the ancient world. And the Israelites had slaves too later on. Don't forget. It's not that Jews didn't have slaves. Jews had slaves, and Jews were slaves. That was the economy of all the ancient world, and nobody thought of it as being evil. So David said to him, "Can you lead me down to that band?" He replied, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into my master's hands, and I'll lead you down to that band." Now, this happens repeatedly in the Torah, where people say, "Swear to me by God." And what he probably means is by your God. You're swearing by my God doesn't mean anything, but swear by your God. And everybody's got to assume that you wouldn't actually swear by your own God and then violate it. It's the only sanction that he's got. First of all, he's powerless because they can kill him anyway, but he wants that protection. And in fact, nobody's going to violate that. They may find a loophole, but they're not going to violate that because presumably you swear to God and you violate it, God's going to take revenge. And you know that for a long time still held sway in court. I mean, why do you put your hand on a Bible? That may seem ineffective now, but obviously that's because people really didn't want to put their hand on a Bible and then lie. Okay, so he led him down, and there they were, scattered all over the ground, eating and drinking and making merry because of the vast, I love that, Ochlim v'shotim v'chogigim, which means celebrating, like chag, chogigim. That's what they were doing. They were making like shavuos. Maybe not. Okay, so they were eating and drinking and making merry because of all the vast spoil that they'd taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. So it wasn't just that the Amalekites were raiding the Philistines. They were also raiding David's native land. They were raiding anywhere they could, anywhere that they thought that they would get David attacked them from before dawn until the evening of the next day. So that's a fairly long battle, and it must have been a pretty bloody one, right, to fight for that long. Because again, remember, David had how many people with him?
400.
That's nothing. I mean, that's not very many people. And you've got to assume that the Amalekites had probably around the same number of people. None of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and got away. This sort of detail argues for the historicity of, because we know by this time there's a big, big argument in biblical studies. You would not believe how many articles have been written about this, about whether camels existed in the time of Abraham. They exist, not existed in the world, but existed in the ancient Near East in the time of Abraham. It's a huge controversy, and one of the reasons why it's a huge controversy is because the early biblical critics who said that the Bible was a product of human beings who wrote later pointed to the existence of camels in the time of Abraham and said they didn't exist. So then the traditionalists argued that they did in the time of Abraham, and there's a lot of literature on it. I don't know what the current state of play is. But by the time of David, they did, and which, remember, is hundreds of years later. And so they, so obviously the people who escaped, they saw that the battle wasn't going well. They jumped on, it's like they jumped on their horses and rode away, except in this case, obviously camels are better suited to the desert. Let's just finish this section and then we'll take questions and comments. David rescued everything the Amalekites had taken. David also rescued his two wives. I don't think that's in order of priority, but nonetheless. Now, nothing of theirs was missing. Young or old, sons or daughters, spoil or anything else that had been carried off, David recovered everything. David took all the flocks and herds, which the troops drove ahead of the other livestock, and they declared, "This is David's spoil." In other words, God enabled David to completely get back everything that had been taken, with interest. That's right, and it's only going to reinforce David's status among his posse. Okay, questions, comments about anything up to now? Yeah.
I didn't understand the connection when you made the comment about the camels and whether the Torah was written by man or not.
Because if camels didn't exist in the time of Abraham and they're mentioned, that means it was a later document that was, they retrojected camels onto Abraham's time, even though in fact they didn't exist then. That the people who wrote it didn't realize that they didn't have camels in Israel in Abraham's time, and they assumed that they did. Yeah. The question isn't whether there are camels in Egypt. The question is whether there are camels in the Fertile Crescent where Abraham was, which is a different question. I don't know how far back camels go in Egypt, but that's an interesting question too. But different, I mean, do you know the book Guns, Germs, and Steel?
Yeah, but camels were used.
So that's the question in part is that Guns, Germs, and Steel, the reason I bring it up is he asks the question there, why it is that certain civilizations have advanced and other civilizations haven't. And he rejects the idea of racial differences, and what he bases it on, this is Jared Diamond, who's at UCLA, just wrote a new book actually. What he assumes is the case, although it's a disputed thesis, but nonetheless, what he assumes is the case is that that it has to do with the minerals and the development of the land in which the civilization grows up, and also has to do with the animals who live there for domestication. He says, because if you live in a territory where all you've got are lions and tigers and bears, you're going to end up with a very different civilization than if you live in a territory where there are camels or horses, which enable you to cover large distances, to use them for labor, or if you have oxen, to plow fields. You can't do that if you live, for example, in Africa, if you live in a part of Africa where there are only wild animals and not animals that are easily domesticated. So I don't remember the examples he gives. The other thing he says, which is, I always thought this was an amazing and fantastic observation, was that a lot of it also has to do with how contiguous and unified is the area that you live in. So he says, for example, when Columbus decided that he wanted to find a shorter route to India, he first went, you know, Columbus went to, he was Italian. He went to the Italian government and they said, no, we're not going to invest in this. Then he went to Ferdinand and Isabella from Spain and they said, yeah, we'll invest in this. And so Columbus discovered America. Had Diamond said, Columbus been Chinese, he would have gone to the Chinese government. Had they said no, there was no other government. Europe, he said, was divided up into all these different governments. One of the reasons why Europe was a more dynamic civilization was because if it didn't work in this place, you could go to that place. But if you lived in a country where there was only one government and they said no, then it was no. So a lot of things, and that has to do with geography. That's why Europe is divided up into all these different countries. It has to do with mountains and rivers and all these natural borders. You know, the Pyrenees, he said, had more to do with Columbus discovering America than European culture. Because as long as there were different countries, you could be, I don't know, a capitalist, basically, right? You could go from one place to the other. So the same thing, here, which is that the fact that there were camels greatly advanced the possibilities of civilization. Greatly advanced. Yeah.
I'm trying to conceptualize what I would make of the number 200 fleeing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine what percentage of their troops was that.
Well, if there were 600, it's a third of David's troops.
Somehow it just doesn't compute that that
many. Well, numbers in the ancient world are not the most reliable thing, but 200 is not an implausible number, I don't think. Or that David had 600 people with him. It's a fairly large band of people, but I don't know, with women and children, how much is that? What is that? It's got to be like 1,500, 2,000 people altogether. It's a pretty big group with women and children, and obviously not a hair on their head was harmed. So, which also, what's that? Well, those are 400 who fled. But if we're, again, and it says that they were the kids, not the men, so. Who knows? Remember, the people in the ancient world were accomplished at certain things at ages that seem impossible to us, and an 8-year-old could probably jump on a camel and run away with no problem, even though that doesn't mean he could fight as an adult. Because this was a world in which, as you know, being 13 was adulthood. It really was adulthood. I mean, you were married at 14 and, you know, and you were dead at 35. So, Rabbi. Yeah.
So I get the Amalekite children are going to become the slaves. But now we've got a whole portion of Jewish children, but no fathers.
Unless they rejoin them, which I assume they're going to do, that they're going to go back and rejoin them, yeah. And then there'll be the question of do they get the same share of spoils, and they don't. What happens is that they get their wives and their kids, but they don't get any of the bounty. So that's the price you pay. I mean, because some of them may have made a calculation, too. Some of them may have held back, not because they were out of breath, but because they thought, these people are all going to get killed. And you know, my wife and kids are already gone. So that's, however, having, yeah, go ahead. Yes.
To overcome all adversity is so inspirational on some level that it's baffling. You know?
David is extraordinarily charmed. There's no doubt about that. And this is an early. It's not the only, by any means, but it is an early desperate crisis.
Yeah.
We see him about to be killed by his own men. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Everything he recovered from
I agree. It would make a good movie. Yeah.
About the how much the guys that stayed behind at the river, how much they would share in the spoils.
Yes.
My translation says that David said they will share and share alike, and he will.
Look at no. Oh, yeah, no, right. That's what they eventually do, right? But that's David's, David proves to be, but the standard is they get their wives, their kids, they don't get the spoil. One of the ways that David is going to prove that he's this different kind of leader is by contradicting his troops. His troops will say they don't get, and David says, no, they do. But the assumption is when they abandon the troops that they will get their families back, but they won't get the bounty back, and that's the way it almost always works, and that's the way you'd expect it to work. Other. Okay, so we'll read that section. When David reached the 200 who were too faint to follow and who'd been left at Vadi Basor, they came out to welcome David and the troops with him. David came forward with the troops and greeted them. But all the mean and churlish fellows among the men who accompanied David spoke up, since they didn't accompany us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we seized, except that we each may take his wife and children and go. Now, I don't know why that's, although it's true, it says Ish Ra Uvilial, but the truth is that's a reasonable position for them to take, and that's the usual position in the ancient world. But David now shows his magnanimity by saying, you must not do that, my brothers, in view of what the Lord has granted us, guarding us and delivering us in the hands of the band that attacked us. How could any agree with you in this matter? The share of those who remain with the baggage will be the same as the share of those who go down to battle, and they shall share alike. From that day on, it was made a fixed rule in Israel, continuing to the present day. Again, let you know that this was written long after. But the other issue here is that this shows David's faith in God, because the reason that he gives it to everyone is because God gave it to him. That's why, right? He says, listen, God gave us all this stuff, so we don't want to slight God's generosity by not allowing this group to have what it is that they would otherwise have. And it's those small or not so small hints that lets people know that David has this deep faith that inspires his troops. And one of the reasons probably why they believe when the priest says you're going to get back what you get back. Okay, let's finish off the chapter. When David reached Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah and to his friends, saying, this is a present for you from our spoil of the enemies of the Lord. What's this called? Making allies. Notice he sent the spoil to the elders. And why is this repeated twice? Not entirely clear, but either because they want to emphasize that he sent it to the elders, or because it's a careless manuscript copying. In Bethel, Ramoth, Negev, Yatir. Oh no, it's not that. I'm sorry. It's that it's picking up from where it was before. It just says the names of the cities and wants to let you know that this is what it's saying. He sent the spoil to the elders of those places. In the towns of the Yerachmeelites, in the towns of the Canaanites, in Hormah, Borashan, and Atchad. Please don't ask me where these are because I don't know. And to those in Hebron, all the places where David and his men had roamed. So I'm guessing that when he went through these cities, sometimes he took stuff because he had these troops to support. So now he's giving them payback so that they won't resent him, and so that the next city that he goes to, he'll have a reputation as somebody who rewards the city that gives him shelter, which is important because if he's going to be the king of Israel, then he's going to want as much support from as many widespread towns as he can possibly get. Okay, end of 30. Any questions about the chapter, comments about the chapter? Yes?
Mm-hmm. I consider, in my imagination, these encampments of small villages.
Yeah.
I think of fixed structures.
Some ancient cities had walls. We know that. But most of them, yeah, were probably what we would think of as encampments, as opposed to, and they were built around water. And I can't imagine that they had, I mean, they probably had clay or mud or structures like that. Although in Israel, in David's time, there are remnants of stone dwellings. So I don't know if they've done Philistine archaeology and what that shows. But presumably they could build from stone too, and they certainly were skilled with bronze, so I don't know what they, I really don't, what kind of structures they had. I'm sure that our reading of the book of David and the Torah in general would be dramatically changed if we could spend a day in ancient Israel. I'm serious. And you would see what a city looked like and how people lived. And you've got to assume that it would be a very different experience, because life was so radically different from anything that we know. But the same thing about like marauding beasts, which we don't even think about. Or when the Talmud says that it's the obligation of every parent to teach their kid to swim, because there were water holes all over the place and kids fell in them all the time. So it was just a very different world. Well, they don't think that the book of Samuel was written then. They think the book of Samuel was written later. We're just talking about the five books of Moses were given at. But even there, you have the same dilemma. If you say that all of the Torah was given at Sinai, then why didn't Moses, for example, know that the rebellion of Korach was coming, since that happens later? So some people will say that it was given gradually to Moses over time, that only a certain part was given at Sinai and the rest. It's not an easy position to sustain that the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai. You can, but it's not an easy one.
But so. There are Orthodox people who say that it was given at that time, am I right?
Yes, yeah. When they're challenged about what? In which way?
If the world was written at that time, how come we have some words or phrases that says later on?
You don't exactly have that in the Torah. You have other things that could be, the phrases in the Torah that suggest until this day, where you have, there are two ways to defend it. One is by reinterpreting the words, and the other is by saying the things were put in the Torah for later generations, so that when the later generations read it, they would know that even to this day, that's still the case. Because obviously God knew that people would read it and what they would interpret later, exactly. So, and the question of, there's a question in general in religious life of, if God knows what you're going to do, do you have free will to do it? And there's no good answer to that, I don't think. But other questions.
Excuse me. Actually,
that's an interesting question. It depends who you ask. For the most part, traditional thinkers say that we have free will, because it's hard to punish people if they don't make choices. But there are people who still argue, there are one or two famous examples of people who are determinists, who believe that basically, and generally the usual position is to hold both. That is, God causes everything to happen, but people have free will.
And for determinists, do they stone people because it has been determined for people?
Yeah, sure. Determinists do that anyway. Determinists say, look, I mean, it may be that you're determined to do this and you didn't have a choice, but I'm determined to punish you the same way that you're, if it's determinist, it's determinist, right? Everybody's determined. So seriously, but But it's a very, I mean, without, I don't know how you get free will without religion anyway. Because let's say that God doesn't exist and you're a product of evolution. That means you were born with a certain genetic code and you were born into an environment that you didn't pick. Now, if your behavior is determined by your genes and your environment and you didn't choose either of them, you don't have any free will. You do exactly what was programmed by your genetics and your environment. Where does free will come into this? Seriously. Where could you possibly find free will in that?
In your mind.
But your mind is entirely a product of evolutionary forces that you didn't choose. So how do you get free will? What? But it's only flexible within the limits and the directions and the parameters that have already been programmed into your mind. Where is the super you that decides that the you that's physiological is not going to do this, but you're going to do that? But there isn't a range. What part? You're positing this part of you that gets to pick. And I'm saying, where is that part that gets to pick when you're entirely a product of your environment and your genes? You want it, and we assume it, and we believe it, but it's very hard to make the argument that it exists. Yeah.
If you assume that the programming is very rigid, animals adapt.
Yeah, but no, but they adapt because of their environment and because of the flexibility of their program, but they don't choose. Adapting is different from choosing. Right? Choosing means that actually there's a part of me that gets to decide that isn't my mind and isn't my environment, because both of those were given to me. There's a separate part of me, this little independent part, that isn't actually a product of my mind or my environment. Well, where does that come from? I understand where it comes from if you're religious, but if you're not, I can't imagine how you could think that people actually have free will. You could understand how they have the illusion of free will, but how they actually have free will, I don't know where you get it from. Yeah, you're... But how can you choose it if God already knows what you're going to choose? Right. It's a tough one. I mean, religious thinkers have struggled with this one. I'll tell you the solution of Gersonides before we, because Ralbach, Gersonides, was a thoroughgoing rationalist, and he really didn't like the idea that God knew what you were going to do in advance, and therefore you didn't have free will. He insisted we had to have free will. So his solution was as follows. He said, God can only know what is. To ask God to know what isn't is to ask a paradox. It's like saying, can God know a unicorn? Since a unicorn does not exist, God can't know it. And it's no limitation on God to say God can't know a unicorn, since a unicorn doesn't exist. Okay, you with him so far? He said, the future does not exist. Therefore, God cannot know it. God can make very accurate predictions about what will happen, but God can't know it because it doesn't exist. Therefore, God doesn't actually know the future. And you have free will. That was Gersonides. He's the only Jewish thinker that made that argument, but it's a pretty clever one. Yeah.
I heard a different version that we're human, so our mind is human. But God, the word knowledge, we cannot comprehend it in the terms of God.
Yeah. Well, we always use that one. Whenever we can't answer a question about God, we always say we can't understand it. That's a time-tested, yes, right. That's, like, can God make a rock so heavy God can't lift it? The answer is yes, but you can't understand what that means, you stupid question asker. So, yeah, we use that one a lot. I don't know how well it works, but it's the best that we can do. These are, they're difficult. But I just want to say, this whole free will question, it's really, I mean, Sam Harris wrote a book trying to prove that you could get free will without any religious component, and I think that his argument is a complete failure. And the one time that I brought this up, it wasn't with Sam Harris, it was with Christopher Hitchens, in the debate in Boston, and I tried to make this point, although I'm not sure that the host understood, but I said to Hitchens, so where do you get free will from? And he got the point, and that's why he said, I get free will because I decide to have it. Which everyone laughed at. It was a clever line, but the point was that he didn't have a good answer. Because you can't, I mean, that's why, especially biologists, if you ask them, do human beings have free will, they'll say, biologically, there's no way you can account for it. It's true that there might be randomness. That is, maybe not everything is determined. There might be randomness in your mind, but that's not the same as choosing, right? You don't choose random things that happen. They just are random. But in terms of choice, I don't know where you get it from if without God. Yeah.
Without free will, how can you attach responsibility?
You can't. You can't.
Then I'm not culpable for whatever I did.
No, but I'm not culpable for punishing you for it either. I mean, the argument works both ways.
Yeah.
Everybody acts as if we have free will, and everybody's agreed to act as if free will, and nobody lives their life as if we don't. But whether we do as an intellectual question is a really different question. Yeah.
When did
Gershon 1300s. It's Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. And he was one of those guys. He was a polymath. I mean, he was a scientist. His book, I think, either on mathematics or on logic, was used throughout the Middle Ages. He was an amazing, amazing guy, Gersonides. All right. Okay. Please rise.